So we're ready to go. The December 12th, 2022 Finance Administration Committee will now begin. The meeting is being conducted in person at the Rio Vista Water Treatment Plant Boardroom. As a convenience to the public, members of the public may alternatively participate remotely by using the toll-free number or the Zoom webinar link provided in the committee packet, which is posted on the SCB Water website. In the event there is a disruption of service which prevents the agency from broadcasting the meeting to members of the public, the meeting will not be postponed or rescheduled, but will continue without remote process or participation. The remote participation option is being provided at the convenience to the public and is not required. Members of the public are welcome to attend the meeting in person. For members of the public who are present and would like to comment, please complete and submit a public comment card to the administrator to help expedite the process. To participate in public comment from your computer, tablet, or smartphone, please click the raise hand feature in Zoom or dial 9 when I announce the agenda item on which you would like to speak. When it is your turn to speak, please dial 6 to unmute your phone. The process for tonight's meeting are as follows. I will introduce each agenda item. Staff will present on the item. I will ask for public comment first from the members attending in person and then those attending remotely. I will then ask for discussion and questions from committee members. These will be taken in order of hands raised. The committee then comes to a consensus and moves this item to the board for consideration. Any PowerPoint presentation shown at tonight's meeting will be posted on the SCB Water website. So when it talks about the failures and disruptions, that goes for the committee chair too, when I fail and we don't get a recount on that. All right. So moving on to item one, Pledge of Allegiance. Mr. Colley, it's end of Veterans Month, so please lead us.
You place your right hand over your heart. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
We have any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
And item three, presented by Rochelle Patterson, recommend receiving and filing the Water Annual Compensation Financial Report as of June 30, 2022.
Yes, so we should have Brandon from our auditing firm, LSL CPAs, online to go over the oral presentation for the fiscal year 2022 audit.
Thanks, Rochelle. Can I get a thumbs up if you guys can hear me? Yeah, good. All right, I apologize. I'm in the car and traveling unexpectedly for a funeral, so hopefully I don't get disconnected. Here goes nothing. So again, thanks, Rochelle. My name is Brandon Young. I'm a partner with LSL CPAs. We've been performing the audit for the agency for, I think this is our fourth year, I want to say now. And again, overall, it was a very smooth, successful year, even with new GASB implementations. Rochelle and Amy and her team, they're incredibly responsive with information, timely with requests. So we really appreciate working with the agency and look forward to future years. So I'll go over the audit results overall, point out a couple of new things in this year's financial statements and answer any questions that you all have. So I'm going off the page numbers in your packet. So the first letter in the packet, I believe is packet page number 11. It should be a letter, an audit communication letter. All right, assuming you guys are there. So it just has a date at the top. So what this really is a summary letter of the audit overall. If there were ever any issues that we had with management where we had to, they either were not forthcoming with information or they were not willing to disclose information that we were asking for, if we had any disagreements on numbers or how things should be reported, we would have to disclose it in this letter. We've never had any issues like that whatsoever with the agency. So it's a standard, fairly standard audit language letter. The one paragraph I'll point out, on the first page, you'll see an indented paragraph that talks about management's estimates. What that's telling you is that the pension and the OPEB liability, which I know we've touched on every year and we'll touch on it every year, it's an estimated number that swings back and forth with factors that are really not under anyone's control. The primary factor being the rate of return on investments for CalPERS and really the stock market. An example being this current fiscal year 22 is based on 2021 numbers, which the stock market did very well. So the pension liability decreased significantly. Next year, it's going to go up significantly because in 22, the stock market didn't perform as well. So what this paragraph is telling you is that we evaluate the actuarial reports that are given to us. I'm going to make sure that the proper information is disclosed, but those numbers swing back and forth. And we're not the ones calculating those. On the last page of the letter, this kind of leads into the next part. You'll see an area talking about new accounting pronouncements. The one that was effective this year is GASB 87, which has to do with leases. What that entailed is for those in finance world, there used to be operating and capital leases, which that has since gone away. All leases are now reflected the same way. And I'll point out the footnote that pertains to in the financial statements. The one coming next year is GASB 96, which is a similar pronouncement that has to do with any software subscriptions that the agency has, like your ERP system. Those are going to be now reflected on the books a different way, almost the same way that a lease is shown. So it's quite an undertaking that we worked hard on with Amy and Rochelle to get the numbers accurate. So that's the main change this year that I will point out in a minute here. Getting into the report, I'm going to go to the opinion letter, which is going to be, packet page 37, looks like. Titled the Independent Auditor's Report, also referred to as the opinion letter. What this is, your guys' is a standard audit language. You guys received an unmodified opinion this year on the financials, which is the opinion that you want to receive, meaning that the information disclosed in here, the numbers you see and all the line items have been tested, verified through sampling procedures, analytical procedures, and the disclosures are accurate and the district has, or the agency has proper support for all of the numbers. The letter is lengthy because there's a lot of just standard audit language. There's nothing out of the ordinary here. You'll see a page in the first paragraph talking about emphasis of matter. That's talking about that GASB 87 principle, just letting you know that there was a new pronouncement this year, changing the way leases are reflected. Nothing else in this letter is out of the ordinary that we haven't discussed in the past. So I'm going to move to that footnote to show you guys. So footnote, let me find the page here. So note, where is it?
I think it starts on page 82 of the packet.
Okay, the first one I wanted to actually go to page 79 of the packet. One other thing I wanted to mention this year to y'all.
Mm-hmm. He's messing with you.
Yeah. You should check it away. So page 79, there's a long-term debt footnote. This one I wanted to touch on those 1999 revenue, those Series A bonds. Those are capital appreciation bonds that are fairly uncommon in the industry nowadays, but you all still have them. And this year, what has changed is you'll see the line that talks about accreted interest. Starting in fiscal year 22, now those are being paid down. Those essentially, the principal balance has been increasing every year over the last basically 20 years since those bonds were issued. Now, over the next 10 years, I think $10.5 million a year is being paid down on that debt. So it just changes the way the debt footnote is going to look. And then we changed the way it was disclosed on page 81, I think. No, I'm sorry. Page 82. You'll see basically the principal and the interest payments. I'm sorry, that's not where it's at. What note is it? I'm sorry, the table was on PDF page 80. I'm having you jumping all over the place. So the $10.4 million now is being paid down over the next 10 years, where previously there was no principal being paid on that debt. So that you'll see being paid down now through, I think, fiscal year 2031. So that's just a little bit of a change this year for the long-term debt balances. Moving forward to the lease footnote. So it starts on PDF page 82, like Rochelle had mentioned. It says note 9, leases. So this if nothing else, it just extended the document by another 3 or 4 pages, which I know everybody's excited about. So basically what this is describing is the leases that the agency is party to and is under contract for, both on the lessee and the lessor side. So I'm not going to obviously read through each one, but if you wanted more detail about the lease receivable balances, meaning the leases that the agency is leasing out equipment to, now are going to be on the books as a lease receivable. And that's part A of the note. Part B is any equipment that the agency leases is now kind of like a fixed asset and a lease payable, which previously anything that was considered an operating lease was not going to be reflected here. So this note has a lot of detail that you can choose to look at if you would like to. And this is new this year entirely. So that's the only reason that I'm pointing it out. Last letter I will touch on is going to be the report on internal controls, which is going to be packet page 103. So this is a required letter for all government audits. It's sometimes referred to as a management letter, yellow book letter. If there were ever any findings or if there was a process that we evaluated that we felt was deficient or there was a weakness or needed significant improvement, or if there was a line item in the financial statements that we had to make a journal entry for, make an adjustment to, we would essentially disclose it here as a finding and a recommendation for next year. We didn't have any of those this year. The agency has historically been ready very timely with trial balance and has all the audit schedules ready to go. So we haven't had any findings, I don't think, really in a couple of years. If there ever were anything, this is where you would find it. So that really is a summary of the audit overall and some changes in the report. So again, it was a successful year. We really appreciate working with you all, and Rochelle and Amy and her team are a pleasure to work with. If you all have any questions about the report, about the audit itself, I am happy to answer them.
Public comment from
within. No public comment at this time.
And nothing online?
Correct.
All right. Committee, questions? You want your one question now? Two questions.
Actually, one was already answered, so it is one. thank you, Mr. Young, for your presentation. You did actually answer one of my questions during your presentation, so that takes that off my list. I just have a big picture question for Ms. Patterson. Can you remind us of how the auditing firm is selected by the agency?
So it was selected by an open RFP. process. So we go through planet bids, we prepare the scope of work and send it out in planet bids. 4 years ago, it had a 3-year contract with a 2-year option to extend. So we're in that first option right now. And then when we hit our 5th year, then we will do the same thing.
That's it. Thank you.
And that procedure goes through the Finance Committee. Right. All right. Seeing no more questions, looking for a recommendation by staff to put it on a consent calendar.
A couple of years ago, it was asked that it was me, but I have delegated to Amy this year to give a brief presentation to the board. And so we will do that at the December 20th meeting.
Oh, good. I won't be at that one. All right, so moving on to item 4, recommend approval of the contract for materials for microwave upgrade.
Thank you, Brandon. You're still on the line.
I'm here. Thanks, everyone. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Well, good evening, Finance and Administration Committee. What we have today in front of you is the memorandum on upgrading some critical communications infrastructure between Rio Vista and Earl Schmidt plant. As some of you may know, Earl Schmidt is a remote, isolated location. There's not a lot of infrastructure in that area. It's just off of Lake Hughes Road. And 15 years ago, Cassaic Lake, the predecessor to our agency now, had installed what probably cutting edge at the time, is some microwave infrastructure to facilitate communications. And I say communications, I mean, telephone, internet, and SCADA communications. And because of its remote location, we couldn't depend on the antiquated infrastructure that's in that area. So to accommodate that, they installed they call it point-to-point communications. So they use microwave to transmit and move data. I think it's about 100 megabits. So right now what exists in currently is 100 megabits per second connection bandwidth. And as most of you know, at any person's home nowadays, you probably at least have 200, if not 300 or 1,000 megabits at your own home. So fast forward to today, that infrastructure is no longer suitable to do modern day business, again, because we're moving both internet, business activity, telephone, as well as SCADA communication to that same portal. I had a beautiful map, but it didn't make it. Communications happens. It doesn't go line of sight from here at Rio Vista over to Earl Schmidt. It has to bounce off a mountain. It has to bounce off what we call the post office tank. There's a big regional post office facility there on Franklin Parkway in Castaic. It's still Castaic. At the end of Franklin Parkway. Then up on the hill, you'll notice there's a water tank up that hill. That's called the post office tank. That's what we commonly call it. And up on top of that tank is infrastructure. It's a repeater. So our communications our microwave communications go from here at Rio Vista up to that tank and then bounce back to Earl Schmidt and vice versa. Without that communications, we wouldn't be able to get our SCADA communications operations at Earl Schmidt back and forth from Rio to Earl Schmidt and Earl Schmidt to Rio. So this project has been challenging because we went out to bid. I think as part of my memo, I've described what we've gone through in this project. We went out to bid twice. We went out to the public RFP process. We went to post it on Planet Bids. We even walked contractors on site on the project, but ultimately we got no bidders. We did that twice. So we didn't. In the second round, we broke the project up into pieces. Okay, we'll break it up into pieces. We'll call it. We'll do hardware and software, and the other part will be installation, and we'll do it that way. Still no bidders. So we went back to council, asked them what we can do, and they suggested that we contact if we had some folks that were interested in the project, go ahead and solicit directly. So we contacted three parties. We got responses back from two, and here we are today to wanting to move forward in those contracts. So one revision to this memo that wasn't captured in the memo kind of came up because of a great question that Director Gutzeit raised last week, is that we were missing a component there. We weren't sure. And we couldn't get the answers whether we can recycle our existing FCC licensing or we needed to go back to the drawing board and get new licensing. So that's not included in this proposal. So that's an amendment that I'm making at this time. I'm saying that. So right now, this proposal, this memo we have in front of you is for more or less, it's approximately $200,000. But we want to revise this to read $220,000. So we've gotten some information back from Nokia. With some FCC details that are the proposal is about $18,700 approximately, and that would cover the process of relicensing relicensing what we have or obtaining new licensing for what we need. So that's a question we don't have answered yet from the FCC, whether we can just amend what we have or we have to go back and to the drawing board and start fresh again. So FCC licenses are in pockets. It ranges depending on what they grant you. I guess it's between 5 and 10 years. You can get an FCC license for that long. And they're relatively not really expensive. The licenses we need are about $1,300. What's costly is all the bureaucracy you have to go through to get that license, all the study and proving that you're not interfering with other people's radio waves. So that's part of that process. And that's not captured in this memo that you have in front of you today. So what our request is, okay, so the project's broken up into three pieces. It's hardware and software, and then it's in the installation of that hardware and software, and then finally it's the FCC licensing, which is approximately $20,000 in addition to what we have in front of you now. So one other thing I wanted to share with everyone is that going through what turned out to be a great thing, breaking up this contract into two pieces, both in the hardware, software, and the installation, is that we're able to leverage what's called NASPO, a NASPO pricing. So NASPO pricing is a nationally recognized, state office, nationally, the acronym is the National Association of State Procurement Officials. And going through NASPO is allowing us to save 50% from going out to public and going at the bid, having a contractor buy this equipment for us. We're saving 50% on the equipment and hardware. So that's been a great, great, awesome savings. Then finally, I think what we're requesting is that the, again, my revised recommendation, it's that the Finance and Administration Committee recommend that the Board of Directors authorize the General Manager to execute contracts for the total amount of $220,000. And that's for the upgrade and installation of the microwave equipment. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Do we have any public comments?
No public comments at this time.
Neither in-house or online. All right. Committees? Ms. Goodside?
Just real quick. Did they say why they didn't bid? Is it like their staffing issue on their side, or any comment about why they didn't participate originally? You must have seen that they looked at it and didn't bid. So.
We physically walked the sites with the contractors the first time. It's the first time the excuses were, I'm gonna say excuses, but the reasonings were that okay, we want to bid on the installation and not the total project. So that was the initial. So that's why the second time we broke it up into two pieces.
Right.
But then they didn't bid again, or no one bid again. So it's something we're gonna follow up again and see what's going on. But again, we got feedback from the first round, so we changed the second round, but still no bidders.
So the same people from the first round eventually bid.
Correct.
The third time you talked to them, they bid.
The third time.
Yeah, around. That would be good to know, because maybe they're short on time or short on staff and just can't meet the deadlines, right? Because there's these hard deadlines.
Correct. I think talking to other folks in our organization, it seems like it's all around. I think operations are facing the same challenge. I think we're all facing it. There's just a different unprecedented type of thing going on in business world. There's not a lot of, makes no sense.
Well, that's what I was I was figuring that was, but if they do let us know, it would be good to know, because that's what I would guess, is just they don't have the bandwidth to respond or in the manner that you need it.
Yeah.
To piggyback on what you just said, I think since this is kind of a theme that we hear also from operations and other departments, that I wonder if it would be kind of, without putting too much extra work on staff, kind of making it a regular habit, if when we're not receiving bids back, if we can kind of have some questions, just a few standard questions, kind of a survey, so we can kind of get a sense of why. So I think we always ask that when we hear there was no bids. Well, why? That's going to be an automatic question from, I think, all of us. So just a suggestion to throw out, that maybe have some, like a really small survey to kind of get a sense of what the issues are.
I guess I may not answer the survey.
Well, I don't know if we have relationships with any of the people to reach out to them and see if they're willing to answer the questions. So
We'll pursue that. That's a great idea.
Yeah. And then let's see, so that was, you answered that. Just a comment, you noted in your memo that you said the new system will have the ability to be upgraded, which I thought was really good. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because it seems like that'll make things easier in the future when we need another upgrade, which might happen. I appreciated that detail. And then you mentioned an alternative network redundancy. You said staff is investigating alternative network redundancy, which will be included in future project and upcoming budget years. Could you just expand a little bit on that?
Sure. Yeah. So right now, let's say kind of all our eggs are in one basket right now. We have one way to communicate in and out of that facility. Let's say Earl Schmidt. So we're looking at, and we're testing this out now. We've been testing it for a while, but we're looking at satellite technology. So there's a service out there, and satellite's been around for a long time, but There's a company now that exists that also make electric cars, and they have a tremendous amount of satellites in space. And what that allows for is a shorter response time. So once upon a time with, you know, what exists, like HughesNet, there's satellite internet, there's a couple of different satellite internet options. But like, for example, HughesNet, they don't have a lot of satellites. And the triangulation and the response time for your data to get from on the ground into space and back to on the ground, there's a humongous lag. But now this new company with this thousands and thousands of satellites allows for a quicker, I forgot the terminology it's called, but it's called a ping, I think it's called. The response time from communication getting from on the ground to satellite back to the ground is such that we could possibly use that for our some of our data systems and communications and phone systems. So that way, if we're not all, you know, all our eggs aren't in one basket anymore like they are right now, so we're going to explore some alternatives. There's that. We're also in talks with AT&T. We're waiting to hear back on some what the updated costs on infrastructure costs would be. Jeff Herber, who's on the line right now, he's our IT supervisor. He's on the call right now. He's been investigating that because back when he worked for Castaic Lake, they investigated that, and it was about $1 million worth of infrastructure to get some good bandwidth up to Earl Schmidt. So that's a lot of money. And we can, right now we're going to explore all the different options and come back to what's most cost effective and efficient for our operations. You're welcome.
Mr. Cumming.
My first comment is that only somebody who lives in Los Angeles would call that location remote. So I too am kind of curious about the about backup, and I just wanted to ask, have you considered keeping the current system as the backup? I know it would maybe not be as robust a backup as something else might be, in that, you know, power failures would probably affect both and that sort of thing. But has that been thought about, considered?
I could share with you. So we're working on some strategies. We're going to segregate some of the data packets. I didn't get too detailed here, but we're working on another alternative into segregating our SCADA and business operations. So potentially we already have an existing SCADA network in the valley here that moves our SCADA data through a separate network of radio systems. So we're looking at potentially segregating that so that we would have technically redundancy. Then we would have the SCADA as a primary radio network, and then we would utilize this upgraded microwave system as the backup, the new one, not the old one. But in addition to that, we have some more newer data needs. So what we're wanting to do with this upgrade, and this is probably the most critical part of this upgrade, is we want to move giant chunks of data for a daily backup of the treatment plants, so that if this whole entire facility was to collapse and to the ground, we would have a backup of all the data at the Earl Schmidt plant and vice versa. So there's a couple of different avenues we're already pursuing and investigating to make sure we have some redundancy. But as far as utilizing the old infrastructure, it's at end of life. It's 15 years old, and we're already experiencing packet losses and issues now.
Okay. It seems, I guess, self-evident to me that the reliability of the business data transfer is probably significantly less critical than, obviously, the ability to operate the plant
correct
remotely. If that plant has whatever the equivalent of a meltdown is for a water treatment plant,
yeah,
you would want to make sure that you had the operators here would be able to do something about it promptly and not try to figure out a new operator to jump in a car and drive to Castaic. And
so
I would hope that the redundant system is prioritizing that and not the business
correct
data need. So obviously, yeah, if things would not be a catastrophic loss in most cases to lose one day backup and have to fall back to 2 days ago. If the world was coming to an end. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Director Bronson.
Thank you. Also loved everybody else's thoughts on this. I definitely think we need to figure out why we're not getting bids. And I love that it's a scalable program. I was wondering, you mentioned operational failings. Is that SCADA operational failings?
It's they're packet. It's like nowadays, you know, we're on a Teams call and you'll start to get glitches in the middle of it. Those are the kind of operational failings. Those are the type of things that happen. So you'll lose a packet, but then the packet will, you know, data moving back and forth, and you'll lose it for a period of time, and it comes back online. There's been those types of issues.
That doesn't sound very helpful. Okay, great.
Packet. I mean, I'm using packet generically as.
No. I didn't mean your answer. I meant not having the data.
Yeah.
And it popping and going and all that doesn't sound helpful. So that's it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Director Peterson. Chris, on the contracts, one of the things I always ran into was with in the old days was the aspects of insurance requirements on a public contract. Was there any issues with that, with those contractors?
That didn't come up as an issue. I think that didn't come up as an issue to think of.
All right. As far as I notice you have a little comment about fiber optics in here.
Yes.
Are we planning on any fiber optics?
There's fiber optics. The fiber optics that's referenced there is going from the new hardware into the data system. So what that does for us is fiber allows for a larger bandwidth of data movement. Yes. So there's no longer that pinch point. So like, for example, us plugging into a Ethernet cable, we're only limited up to 1 gigabyte of data per second. That's the limitations of a modern day Ethernet cable, as opposed to fiber optics that you can get up to, I think it's 10 gigabits per second. Yeah. So there's an extremely amount of a bigger bandwidth, it's having like a big giant pipe. We have more potential, even though our throughput is going to be up to 2 gigabits. Technically, we have the ability to move up to 10 gigabits if that was available.
Okay. The other aspects of fiber optics is that you sound like you have installed some fiber optics already in the system.
That's kind of modern day technology now. So a lot of our switches and our technologies that we install now, as opposed to using older technologies with their limitations, like I mentioned, the throughput limitations. When it's possible, we're opting for the fiber optic.
Yes, but as far as the comment of your comment about separating the packets, my experience with SCADA systems was always to keep them separate from the business aspects. So I just offer that experience to you.
Thank you.
If you can do that. All right. Thank you.
Kathy Amitage would like round two.
Yeah, sorry. One more comment, I guess, is I'm not sure, how does cybersecurity fit into this? And you don't have to go into I guess my comment is always just cybersecurity is always kind of an evergreen issue for me, something that we should always be thinking about. And I guess my level of worry has been heightened again recently with the infrastructure attacks that we've been seeing in different parts of the country. So it's always kind of at top of mind. So you don't have to give me an answer. I'm just throwing it out that whatever cybersecurity issues are related to this, I just want to make sure that it stays on our radar.
That's a great question. It's a good opportunity to raise that as well. I really appreciate that, because that is now top of mind with every single business decision we make. I think that's number one. If it doesn't meet those minimum criteria, then there's no step two. So that's, again, I think I was having this conversation with someone the other day, but we've come a long way in 5 years. And I think, if I was to say anything we're doing in this business, I can say with confidence, you know, we're best in class in cybersecurity and the way we're looking at it. So thank you for raising that.
This is a good sign.
Just a couple follow-up thoughts as it went around. On security, the most recent attack that we heard about in North Carolina was a physical attack. So if this is bouncing off a tower, essentially in actually a pretty remote area too, I mean, are we looking at physical protection? This is, again, a hypothetical question, like Director Armitage, but, you know, do we look at physical security as well? Because it seems like if you take out that tower, then we have no bouncing going on, right?
Is that correct? That's correct. Yeah, that's correct. Yeah. That is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, physically, if you were to go up on this hill behind us is where all the communications occur.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're able to walk up this hill behind us, there's a shack up there.
Mm-hmm.
And again, if someone was to have some, you know, bad intentions, they could pinpoint our infrastructure and take that out.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you raised that. I'd like to take this opportunity to share something that this organization is about to kick off. So physical security has been a challenge in this organization. You know, there's not one person that's responsible for physical security in this organization. And there hasn't been historically, because our smaller organizations, it was, you know, one of many of our jobs to do this part of it. So we just kicked off. It was 2 weeks ago. I sent out an email. I referenced that the incident in North Carolina in that email because of all the notifications I've been getting from CISA on that. But I brought that in my email I sent out. And so we've created this work group that's going to kick off at the end of January, our first meeting. We'll be meeting quarterly. And this work group is representative of the various departments in our organization. Everyone has a different discipline. Everyone has a different perspective and experience. And the idea is to, together as an organization, tackle the challenge of physical security. So kicking off in the end of January will be our first meeting where we sit down and talk about some of the challenges and issues, and we'll be reviewing, discussing that quarterly and making recommendations, making suggestions, etc. So thank you for bringing that up, and thank you for the opportunity to share that.
Yeah, no, that sounds great. And then the other thing that came into mind after Mr. Peterson mentioned it, on bidding, I know some of the, I don't know if we do this, but another thing that we could look into if we don't, some of the agencies have, you know, how to work with such and such, like City of Santa Clarita does it, like Metropolitan does it, I think City of Los Angeles, they have like these informative fairs. And then also some of the contractors call you directly. If you like express interest in working on like Metropolitan Water, they'll call you. So do we wait for people to respond to Planet Bids? Or are we proactively calling like a list of potential bidders?
Well, it's because of the specialty. I think that grouping is a little smaller. We didn't make attempts to, hey, we have something out there. Reminder, could you put a bid on it? We did do that. Yeah.
This time, but maybe sometimes we don't when we don't get bidders. This
is not,
just mentioned it's been an issue.
Yeah, I bring that up because I was talking to, this is our first time experiencing this, but I've heard that the operations and engineering have both experienced the same thing in the past 2 years. So
in also in Planet Bids, it will go out to everyone who has registered in Planet Bids that has that particular expertise, whether it's plumbing or electrical. But if there are vendors that we want to invite, we make sure that they get logged into Planet Bids and register so they get the bid packet. So, and we can also do an isolated RFP. So if it's a specialized type service and there's four or five vendors that do that, we'll just send it to those four or five, make sure they're all registered as into Planet Bids so they receive the RFP.
Right. Just so they know it's there, because otherwise it's like fire hose and RFQs coming and they may not have time to respond, but if they know it's from us or there's some other direct contact, they might take a look, especially if they're short staff.
Any other last minute comments? Michelle Patterson, how would you like to see? Is it going to be a presentation of the board or you're going to go consent calendar on this?
Consent if everyone is okay with that.
It's under the requirement dollar wise, so consent should be fine. And item five, overview discussion of bill pay options.
Yes, we have Kathleen Wilson here, our customer service manager, and we will kind of tag team, but she's going to go through all of our bill pay options.
Good evening to the members of the committee and everyone else. My name is Kathleen Wilson. I'm the customer service manager, and I will be providing an overview and a discussion of the agency's bill pay options. At a recent Finance and Administration Committee meeting, one of our directors requested that we provide an analysis of the agency's bill pay options and the associated costs for each of those options. Staff also reached out to the agency's benchmark agencies to compare our offerings with that of our benchmark agencies. Attachment 1, which you will see a little bit later in the presentation, shows the results of that survey. And you will also see in attachment 2, the analysis of the costs of our payment options. Next slide, please. The agency currently offers a number of bill pay options to our customers. We accept walk-in payments, which can also be provided to us in our Dropbox, which is available 24/7 outside of the customer care lobby. These are payments that are made in cash or check, processed within the Rockefeller office, and then sent over to Wells Fargo via Brinks. We accept lockbox payments, which are check payments that are processed by our Wells Fargo bank. We accept ECS, which are electronic payments from customers' bank bill pay, and they are also processed and batched by Wells Fargo. We accept phone payments, which is also known as internally as IVR payments. They are made either by credit card or electronic check, and they are processed by our third-party payment provider, Invoice Cloud. We also provide an option for online payments, which can be done through autopay, recurring, and or one-time payments. Again, they can be made through credit card or electronic check, and these are also processed by Invoice Cloud. We accept pay by text, which is again a credit card or an electronic check processed by Invoice Cloud. The type of method is based on the customer's default payment that they have set up in their customer portal. And lastly, we offer a pay near me option, which is cash only. It's processed by pay near me through either a local 7-Eleven or a CVS pharmacy. We accept remittance types on all of these options. Again, as I had noted, we accept cash, paper check, electronic check, a number of credit cards, including American Express, Discover, MasterCard, Visa, and then, of course, as I had indicated, Pay Near Me. Next slide, please. Of the 10 benchmark agency polled, 2 of them are not retailers, and they do not directly bill customers. Therefore, there is no payment information available for them. They are Cayegas Municipal Water District and the Metropolitan Water District. Of the 8 remaining benchmark agencies, 3 offer American Express as a credit card option, one of which charges a processing fee. That fee would be, and it's listed up there, by Burbank Water and Power, it's $2.99 for payments less than $500. It's 1.99% of the total transaction if it's greater than $500. 5 benchmark agencies do not offer American Express as a credit card option. Of the 8 remaining or total benchmark agencies that were polled, 100% of them offered credit cards as a payment option, 6 of which absorb the processing fees and do not charge the customer. 2 agencies do charge customer fees, as I noted. The second, by the way, was Torrance Municipal Water. That's 3% of the total transaction. Of these 8 benchmark agencies, 100% of them offered electronic check, or also known as e-check, as a payment option at no cost to the customer. They all provide internal auto draft or auto pay functionality. This is also known as ACH to the customer using a checking account at no cost. They provide online payment functionality at no cost. They provide phone payment functionality at no cost to the customer. However, one agency limits phone payments to credit card only. They will not accept an e-check or an electronic check. Only two offer the pay near me option, as the agency does. Both agencies provide this option at no cost to the customer. One agency cited two additional payment methods. That was PayPal and Venmo. That was Irvine Ranch Water District, and that's noted on the image on the slide you're looking at now. Next slide, please. A majority of the agency's credit card bank processing fees, also referred to as pass-through fees, currently paid by the agency are government utility rates, which are more favorable than standard rates. The image that we're looking right now at actually is depicts our total payments and in a visual sense, so you can kind of see what the breakdown is. Next slide, please. The government rate is acknowledged by most credit card companies, and each credit card company has a different rate. It would be very difficult to quote what the non-utility fees would be because they vary widely based on the type of card that is used. There are hundreds. To accept credit card payments, merchants must pay interchange fees, assessment fees, and processing fees. These fees go to the card's issuing bank, the card's payment network, and the payment processor. The government utility rate credit card fees charged to the agency equals approximately 0.85% of each credit card transaction amount, plus an average of 23 cents per transaction. InvoiceCloud, to process payments, charges 0.7% of each credit card transaction amount, plus 10 cents per transaction. The non-utility credit card processing fees for merchants equals approximately 1.3% to 3.5% of each credit card transaction amount, plus an average of 18 cents per transaction. Again, it's important to note that the exact amount depends on the payment network, whether it's Visa, MasterCard, Discover, or American Express, the type of card, and the merchant category code of the business. The agency uses, and I've mentioned InvoiceCloud a couple of times, the agency uses a third-party payment processor, InvoiceCloud, and I wanted to tell you a little bit about them. InvoiceCloud is an electronic bill presentment and payment platform, EBPP in the industry. Instead of the agency having to install and maintain bill pay software or hardware and manage its customers' sensitive data, the agency's CIS, which is the customer billing system, is integrated with InvoiceCloud software as a service application. InvoiceCloud hosts the software application securely in the cloud and makes it available to end users, that being the agency and our customers, through a network connection via the internet. This means that as new functionality or configurations are developed and ready for release, they are rolled out to the agency as an enhancement to the existing platform with no additional expense to the agency. Examples of this include features like pay by text and customer bill notifications, ability to set recurring payments, and enhanced biller portal reconciliation tools. These improvements reduce friction in the billing and payment process for our customers and improve operational efficiencies for the agency. InvoiceCloud is a PCI compliant entity, meaning that they adhere to a strict set of requirements, which ensures that all companies that process, store, or transmit credit card information do so in a secure environment. These payment card industry data security standards are managed and enforced by the PCI Security Standards Council, which is an independent body that's created by Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, and JCB, which is Japan Credit Bureau. The agency also accepts Pay Near Me, as I've stated. That is a point of sale POS payment solution that enables cash paying customers to pay their bills at a local CVS or 7-Eleven retail store. They use the barcode that is printed on the back of their bill. The agency partnered with Pay Near Me in late 2019 when the Pine Street customer care location was relocated to the Rockefeller facility. We did so because we found that there were a large number of customers who were utilizing the Newhall customer care location to pay in cash. And we wanted to provide them with an alternative solution that would be convenient and at no cost to them. The platform has since been deployed to all agency customers, regardless of division. Next slide, please. So you'll see ahead in front of you a monthly cost analysis. Staff gathered data from the months of August through October of this year, 2022, and believe that this is a good representation of monthly costs. For purposes of this analysis, the Invoice Cloud and Payneer Me fees are aligned within the month they are reported. The bank fees are closely aligned with that month, but not always exactly because of the timing when the expense hits the books. There will always be those minor fluctuations. On average, for the three-month analysis period, approximately 69,832 payments were received from all payment options. And of those payments, 20,166 were paid by credit card. The total revenue received from credit card payments were $5,699,642, and the total cost to process those charges was $109,656. The total percentage of costs to process credit card payments was 1.924%, and the cost per transaction was $1.83. The recommendation is that the Finance and Administration Committee review payment options and this cost analysis. And this concludes my report, and we are happy to answer any questions you may have.
Any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Why did I know Director Colley would be first?
So thank you. Probably first because I think I was the one that asked for this presentation. My concern is related only to the decision as to who will pay the costs that are basically shown on this side, right? The 1.924% of that $5,699,642. So first I'll ask a question just to make certain that I didn't misunderstand anything. The benefits that we get from the company that does the credit card processing is independent of who pays those fees. Is that a correct statement?
Yes.
Okay. So we're not going to. So I think that the question before this committee and ultimately before the board is, would we want to gain effectively perhaps $300,000 or $400,000 a year by having the customer who wants to pay by credit card pay the fees? And I want to first say that a couple of things. First, I pay as many bills as I can for the most part by credit card because, like most people, I get either 1% or 2%. I've got a credit card that gives me 2%. It's great. And so basically, I only pay 98% of every bill that I pay. And that accrues to me an advantage, and it accrues a disadvantage to the company that I'm paying. Obviously, they only get 98 cents on the dollar or less. And I want to point out that I think that it tends to be folks in this valley who are more affluent that have access to credit cards that provide those rewards, who are more likely to be paying their bills by credit card. So things like Payneer Me, which we also incur a fee, and I don't suggest at all that we stop doing that, because the customer's not motivated by some kind of an advantage in paying by that way. They're perhaps many of them are relatively poor folks that have collected dollar bills and they're going to pay their bill, and that's great. They should do that. And I'm happy. But those customers, the ones that are less well off, are going to end up paying for the fees, the credit card fees, for people like me who use a credit card and get this extra 2%. Okay. And so you're actually transferring wealth in a small way, but transferring wealth, in my opinion, from a relatively well-off community to a relatively not well-off, poorer, if you will, to folks that are more financially able. So I would like to end the process of us subsidizing the payment of credit cards. The folks that want to do that for convenience, terrific. I think that we should continue to offer the option, and we can continue to offer the option. And if they want to do that, they can pay. And the net effect of this would be to give us about a $300,000 to $400,000. Okay. And I think that that's a fair, and talking to staff ahead of the meeting, I think that's a fair assessment that we, you know, because there are many factors that would come in, but certainly we would have a net benefit of hundreds of thousands of dollars per year that we would not be paying in fees that would now be available for things like PAYCO. And so I would like to end the practice of subsidizing credit card payments. That's my reason for asking for this.
So before I take additional questions or comments, I'd just like to determine what's in that pie up there. So many people refer to credit cards as being actual credit cards, and other people refer to debit cards as being credit cards. So is this $5,700,000 strictly the true and original credit card, or is any of it debit card?
Thank you for requesting clarification on that. This is credit card and debit card transactions.
So on the debit card, if I'm correct, we don't pay anything on debit card transactions. We only pay based on credit card transactions, based on California law. Is that correct?
We still pay a processing fee and a per transaction fee.
But it's much less. It's somewhere around 0.2%, if I remember right.
Well, that's the 23 cents per transaction.
Right. Versus if somebody's paying a $100 bill, you know, $3 versus 23 cents. Because I know in our office, we go through the same thing. We explain, if you use your debit card, you know, there's no cost to you. If you use your credit card, there's X cost to you. So I just wanted to clarify that portion of it. So your savings of the 1.9 or the $1.83, whatever it is, may not be 300,000 in the calculations. It may be less than that. Based on what percentage of the 5.7 million would you guesstimate would be ATM versus credit card?
I'm not prepared to answer that. I'd have to go back and look at that.
Okay.
I don't want to throw a number out
that's
wrong.
Fair enough. Not looking to put you on the spot. So you understand where I'm coming from?
Yeah. I'd like to respond, sure. If I could. I'm not going to be angry if we have a little bit of an exchange. So my thinking is that if the number for the debit card is a very small and trivial amount, then it's not going to show up in as much of the cost of that nearly, I think, 400,000 that would be reflected on this slide. So I still think that my estimate of 300,000 to 400,000 is accurate. That amount of money would be available to us. And even if it was a very slight amount, less than 300, I don't think my argument would change much. And I think we should take it as a given that it's going to be impossible to calculate exactly how much more money we would get in advance, but we can be quite certain that it is in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. Is that a fair assessment?
Once again, you're putting her on the spot. So.
Well, I mean, I did ask in advance this meeting that if my numbers were reasonable, and I think I got.
Yes, we just didn't separate versus credit versus debit.
But if the amount of the debit charge is small, then the difference would be small. And I'm not sure, I guess even the question would be, if somebody is paying with a debit card, are they charged? If we transfer the amount that they pay, do we transfer? Does that number all of a sudden become a very large number? Or am I assuming that if we pay a small number, that they would also pay a small number?
I think there's a smaller amount of debit cards than there are credit cards being used. And it's probably less than the e-check fee.
Yes.
Yeah. And okay. So it's difficult to compare apples and oranges, because in my business outside of the water agency, it's actually 70% debit card and only 30% credit card. So I can't really see, personally, I can't really see, because of the economy and everything else, that we've got 30% debit cards and 70% credit cards. But we may, because a lot of, as Ed says, there may be a lot of people in his boat that are not only getting that 2%, return, but they're also getting airline points and other things to go along with it. So depending on the viability of the individual would obviously depend on how they pay. So I didn't want to get everybody sidetracked. I just mostly wanted to get a clarification as to that 5.7 million. And so, Director Bronstein.
So I want to start by thanking Director Colley for finding the money for the ratepayer assistant program. it was very so I appreciate the conversation, and I think that this is a very interesting way of looking at it. I can tell you that many years ago, when we were a young family, we used credit cards a lot because we were in credit card debt because we just couldn't afford to pay things always exactly when they were due. So I think always looking at it through the lens of credit card is something that rich people do is not 100% accurate either.
Don't accuse me of saying I'm rich. I'm just saying
slightly better off. I apologize, not rich.
I'm a teacher.
But I also know that a lot of people, I mean, there's a lot of credit card debt going on right now. And so I wouldn't want to just assume that everybody that's using a credit card it can really afford it either. So I'm just putting that out there in the thought process.
Director Peterson, you have anything?
It's an interesting conversation.
Wasn't really prepared to say anything else other than that most likely we have you see from the study that has done really well, I thought, how the finances work on credit cards and the payment processes. But one thing I can tell you from an experience from customer service is that you get a better customer satisfaction when they have different options for payment, including credit cards.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So
just to be clear, now I haven't proposed that we eliminate the option to pay by credit card. Never. Don't say that I've proposed that. Not at all.
But see, they won't use it. But from my experience with the CPUC regulated utility, we did not allow credit cards because the CPUC says that we cannot finance credit card payments out of your water rates. So therefore, we never had that opportunity in those days anyway. I think they have it now, but I think it's a payment process too. But we have made our customers aware of the credit card option without a payment. And that payment, if we add that payment to it, I think we will have a lot of interesting comments made to us as a board. So that's my opinion.
You have any questions?
Well, first, I want to preface by saying that this is really interesting. I think all this information that whoever on staff gathered all this information and compiled it for us for the presentation, thank you to whoever did that. You can tell a lot of work went into it, and thank you for your presentation. It was reassuring to me to see how many different ways that the agency allows our customers to make their payments, and I think that's really fantastic. So, you know, kudos to everyone who's making that availability. I am still open to listening more on this issue in terms of whether or not we want to ask our customers to take on the additional fees for using their credit card. I don't have an opinion right now to offer on that, but I will keep an open mind and kind of keep listening. And then one question I do have is what's called lockbox. Are those just physical checks? Those are physical checks. Okay.
Yes, that's correct. They're physical checks that are mailed into Wells Fargo, along with the remittance, the coupon that goes in the envelope for paper customers.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Dr. Goodsign.
Yeah. Actually, I do think it was a really interesting discussion on why people use credit cards. And I'll offer up a third reason is credit cards offer significant protection for the consumer versus coughing up your bank account for any reason, you know, online, having your routing number and all that out there, or debit card. It's harder to correct errors. And I want to say it was DWP that had some errors where they and it may have been misspelling, but either way, getting money back that came out of your checking account by mistake is much harder than getting money back from a credit card. So it's a consumer protection issue as well. You know, and I would lean towards making things easy for our customers and try to, you know, look for efficiencies. And and that brings up, so I was going to say efficiencies and operations, 300,000 out of how much annual budget? I should know, but I don't.
It's about 89 million.
So, I mean, we could probably find 300,000 from other efficiencies other than irritating customers. Actually, when I go to the gas station, you see the price for gas. If you buy a car wash on a rainy day, you can get cheaper gas. I mean, not just on a rainy day, but you know, why is it cheaper to buy gas because you're getting a car washer? Like, why would you pay $3 more to use your credit card? It just seems like a minor irritant that isn't really a lot of money.
Sounds like we're not charging enough for water for the car wash.
And then as far as efficiency, though, I would also question, I mean, very good point by Director Bronstein. I mean, if not taking the credit cards leads to more collections, I mean, if you put on your credit card and it's auto pay on the credit card, it's going to hit every single month unless that person remembers to stop it, versus are they going to pay late? Are we going to have more costs incurred with customer interactions, potentially more shutoffs? You know, that shift could make it a wash if we spend more time on customer service. So there's a lot of ways to look at it. I'm not inclined to target that payment method for recouping the cost myself.
All right, so kind of wrapping it up from my standpoint, whether Director Colley is correct with 300,000 or whether it's 100,000, it's still a sizable amount of money that the agency's paying, which comes out of its own budget and its own costs. So actually, I would be in favor of researching a little bit more and coming up with a cost that would be charged to the customer and let them make the options as to whether or not they want to use cash, check, debit card, Venmo, whatever it is we offer, which they obviously take that opportunity now. Staying with this real quick, you had, I can't remember what you call the program, but you had people that are paying at 7-Eleven and other places.
Correct. That's the Pay Near Me program.
Okay. Don't we pay the 7-Elevens for their collections?
Yes, that's not their, because it's, yes, that's correct. We do pay just a transaction fee. It's $1.99.
Right. So we pay them for people paying cash.
That is correct. It's a processing fee.
Right. And so once again, we still have an outlay above and beyond the credit card outlay for people that do want to pay in cash. And I don't know what percentage pays, you know, with the outpay versus the rest of it, but I imagine it's fairly sizable. I think we had a survey with the people in Newhall for a while that they were all looking at going to some location rather than, paying by check and things of that nature. I also...
About 700 average transactions per month.
These numbers, they're small compared to the numbers of paying.
And those are transactions. So 35,000 transactions means that
853 compared to, say, Visa, which is 14, almost 15,000.
Okay.
So it's a small number of paying their lead. And again, I think those.
So anyway, just a point I wanted to bring up. The other situation, just real fast, on, I think it was your first slide, on the Dropbox.
Yes.
I don't know if you have the ability to go back to the first or second slide. Yeah, that one there. So walk-in, Dropbox, mail-in, it says cash or check. So do we have people that are dropping cash into the boxes? And if so, how do we protect them and how do we protect us?
On extremely rare occasion, will a customer place cash in an envelope to the Dropbox? It happens very rarely. There is a sign outside of the Dropbox indicating no cash, and it's very difficult to get into. It's designed with security so that you can't reach your hand in or stick a utensil in to get anything, but it's extremely rare. And we might see it once a quarter.
So it's probably rare that somebody would say, I put the cash in the box and we're saying you didn't. So do we have many challenges on that?
In my 11 total years with the agency, that's never come up before. I did hear of an instance prior to that, one instance where a customer stated that they had put cash in the Dropbox and it was not there. So that's not an issue up to this point.
All right, great. So we have basically just communication today, reviewing. Uh-oh, I woke up the sleeping giant. Yes, ma'am.
Didn't realize I was sleeping. I was wondering if we looked into PayPal and Venmo. And I'm just wondering, so we have many redundancies in our in the system right now. We really offer a lot of different, so I'm wondering if there was a way to consolidate some of them or something, or to see if PayPal and Venmo's, I don't know what their processing fees are. They might be horrible and we don't want to use them. But I was
So that is something that we've looked into and it's on our list. In order to get advantageous pricing, we probably have to promise them a much larger volume than we would be able to otherwise provide them. We do have additional options through Invoice Cloud, who negotiate government fees and reduced fees for us based on our total volume of transactions. That's a possibility and is on the list to look at. I actually put it on, it was supposed to be for 2023, and we were going to start looking at it towards the end of this year. I kind of held off on that until we had some better direction from the committee and from the board before we started checking into that and looking into marketing new programs. And as far as to your comment about consolidating, it's been our culture up to this point to expand options because everyone pays in different ways. As it was pointed out, some customers pay with credit card because they need the float. That happens a lot on our disconnect days, on our shutoff days. And in the 24 to 48 hours prior to that, we see our credit card payment transactions going up because that's how people are avoiding shutoff or getting reconnected more quickly. Some are doing it for their points. Some people go to Pay Near Me because that's the only they can get there at 8 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and it's really convenient for them, which is wonderful. So we try to expand our options rather than consolidate. But I'll definitely, you know, continue that discussion based on the direction we received from the committee and from the board and looking into expanding that. Yeah, Apple Pay is another one.
Well, because I saw Venmo at one of the grocery stores, a Venmo option now. And I was like, wow. So, because I don't know what the quantity is or whatever, but I think almost everybody nowadays has access to PayPal and Venmo. And actually, and in fact, a lot of people that don't use credit cards for points use PayPal and Venmo, kind of thing. It might even be the people that do the Pay Near Me. Like it just seems that those platforms are a little bit more flexible mm-hmm. for people. So that might be a good, like you said, it might be a volume thing. It might be a way that simplifies it if it's low enough mm-hmm. for it to catch many types of payers.
So I've added it to my list.
So I think in general, great presentation. It brought out a lot of thought, a lot of questions. And I'm hoping that Director Colley got what he wanted out of the presentation.
Not yet.
As far as information. But if there's no decisions to be made tonight, but there's recommendations.
My preference would be to set ourselves on some kind of a path that the full board will have an opportunity to consider eliminating the subsidy that all the taxpayer or all the ratepayers pay for those that want to use credit cards. I don't know if that's an action or if that's a direction to staff or what that is, but I don't want to just receive this information and have expressed my opinion and have, okay, thank you. That's not my, yeah. So I want to go in some kind of a path that would end up with ending the subsidy or credit cards, not for anything else.
Rochelle, do you feel we're at a point to make those decisions and this should come back with a little bit more direction to be able to go to the board? I do feel that this is a subject matter and financial burden that we could, I think it's basically 3-2, three people are saying no. And both, you know, Ed and I are saying, yeah, I feel there should be some way to recoup those dollars and cents. But what would you need to bring it back to the point to where it could be voted on?
I think just some additional direction because, you know, who do we want to charge just customers using credit card? Because every payment method has a cost.
Mm-hmm.
Even cash has a cost because we pay the courier to come collect the cash and take it to the bank. So I think if it's just strictly credit cards, you know, what percentage are we looking at? Is it if it's over a certain amount, under a certain amount, what percentage are we looking to recover? Because it does vary. We need to make sure we charge the cost of service. Maybe we want to, if we are going to charge, maybe it's a little bit less.
Can I ask a question related to that specifically? As I recall, when this conversation was had 3 or 4 years ago, we were faced with a binary choice. Either the
costs are. We tell the company that does the credit card payment collection, you charge the customer or you charge us. And the costs are not the same for those two things, but it was a binary choice then. Are you telling us that it's not really a binary choice now, that there's some kind of a middle ground, that there's a scale along which we could do offer to pay part and we could?
Well, I'm just, because of under the government utility rate, each credit card, whether it's Visa, MasterCard, American Express, Discover, have a different rate, and each bank has a different rate, which is why Kathleen said there, you know, that there could be 100 different charges. We've kind of taken our statements and melded them because we can't really come up with one. So on average, it was about 0.85% as a blended rate for the government utility rate. So that's the one fee. And then there's a per transaction fee. And then there's the payment processing company, which is iCloud, the third party transaction that keeps it safe and secure. So that's 0.7%. And then there's another 7 or 10 cents.
10 cents.
10 cents on top of that. So we can, if we want to, we could charge the customer all of that. I just want to make sure we're cost of service and if it's going to be a percentage of the bill or a flat amount.
Well, when it comes to, I'm not sure how it works on the government side, but when it comes to the retail industry, you're right, every third-party processor charges a different fee, and that's why people change processors all the time so they can cut their overhead. But I also noticed that a tremendous amount, whether it's restaurants or other places that are starting to do it, they've averaged out their cost, and hypothetically, they may be charging, you know, $2.25%, even though they may be paying American Express 3 and it may be paying somebody else 1.75. So the average comes out just as a blanket ticket. So from that standpoint, and everybody, all the other costs are just normally absorbed. The processing fee and everything else are absorbed. And if you absorb those for the credit cards, it's kind of like absorbing the dollar for the 7-Elevens. It's somewhere along the line, it's going to average out to a reasonable amount of money. Go ahead, Ed. Yeah,
well, I would also like to add, sorry, you weren't looking this way. You know, if we're going to explore this further, I would have two questions. One for legal counsel, are we allowed to treat different customers differently? So if somebody chooses the pay near me, are we allowed to make assumptions and say, you people, we're not going to charge you an extra fee. And then you people that use a credit card, we are going to charge you a fee. Because I know certainly with the rates, we're not allowed to do that. So, you know, is there any legal issues with a utility? And I know retail does it, but is a public utility charging some customers a processing fee and some not, depending on the pay? So that's a legal question. And then secondly, you know, if staff, I saw you nodding your head when I talked about shutoffs, and if we're getting these credit cards come in right before shutoff notice, I mean, I do not want to save $300,000 and spend $400,000 because more people are getting shut off, nor do I not want to value making things convenient for our customers. It is convenient. And to me, anything I can pay, and I actually don't pay my water bill with a credit card, but a lot of other things, if I want to be protected, I'm going to pay with a credit card. So that's a anxiety issue for customers. Do they want that added protection of knowing if there's a problem that they can work with a credit card processor? You know, there's a customer goodwill component that I think we need to consider. And lastly, you know, I agree with adding Venmo and PayPal if we can, if it's through, especially if it can be rolled into the, whatever the iCloud or
Invoice Cloud.
Because a lot of them that'll, you know, when you do online shopping, it'll be like this credit card, or pay with PayPal. Mm-hmm. So, you know, some just give it and make it another little button. Click that they could do, maybe. But I don't think it's a foregone conclusion that the credit card user should have to pay and the other people don't. It doesn't seem, there may be legal issues, I think.
With regards to the pay near me, do we pay 7-Eleven and 7-Eleven charges a customer, or they charge the customer and they keep the dollar?
We actually, our contract is through, as actually through Pay Near Me, which is a third party processor that struck up these agreements with 7-Eleven and CVS. So our relationship is with Pay Near Me, the point of sale retailer being CVS or 7-Eleven merely scans, collects the money, and whatever their reimbursement agreement is between Pay Near Me and 7-Eleven is between them. We're not privy to that information.
Okay. All right. So I can see we have a variety of questions and directions that could go on for an indefinite period of time here between the public sector and government sector. So do you have some information on direction to go? Do you?
I don't think so.
I didn't think so.
No.
Okay. So without going to the board, do you have additional direction that you'd like to give them to come back with suggestions? Not a suggestion to make the payment, but a suggestion to come up with additional values to be able to make a decision.
So I appreciate the presentation that I've gotten and the exchange that I've been able to have ahead of the meeting based on the information that was provided in the packet. And the information that's been provided to me is sufficient for me to want to gain the benefit of an additional third of $1 million per year by stopping the subsidy for credit cards. I understand, you know, the arguments that have been made. I wouldn't think that it's reasonable to anticipate hundreds of thousands of dollars in loss from additional shutoffs, because I think that the majority of customers that are using their credit card on the day of the shutoff probably are not going to be deciding to endure a shutoff because they don't want to pay a couple bucks in extra fees. I think they'll probably just absorb the extra couple bucks in fees and pay with a credit card anyway. So I don't think that the concerns have been raised have changed my mind. And I don't think it's a bad idea to run it by our legal counsel, but I seriously doubt that there's any legal impediment to eliminating a subsidy. And I also think that it's important to say that the terminology we use, okay, we are not charging the customer the fee in order to use the credit card. The credit card company and the processor would be charging a fee because, you know, for example, I recently renewed a reservation or registration on a car, and the state of California allowed me the opportunity to pay the new registration by using a credit card. And that's a convenient way to do it. I think probably there's a way I could send in a check or whatever, but I didn't. I absorbed the fee. There's a company that the DMV uses to process that credit card, and that company charged me a fee, and they gave the money for the registration to the DMV. So whatever it was, $300, DMV got $300, and I was out $304. I don't know. I don't remember the numbers exactly. But it's a subsidy that I'm sure the people that are getting the subsidy like. And I think that the folks that are not taking advantage of the subsidy would prefer to not provide the subsidy. I don't think that's a difficult thing for me to figure out. And if I did a survey of all of my constituents, I'm darn sure that I know what the answer would be. That the folks, the 70% that are not getting the subsidy would say, I don't want to pay the subsidy for other people to use a credit card. So if it's convenient that people want,
It costs them a few dollars, a couple bucks, whatever, to take advantage of that convenience and the security and the lack of worry. And so, fine, but that, you know, that there's folks that are going to do that, and I would have no complaint whatsoever.
Mr. Stone, I'm going to drag you in here in the sense that this is brought up for review. We have a director that would like to see it go to the board for a vote. Where do we stand off of this review in recommending that, or does it need to come back with the intention of discussing it to go to the board?
I'll tread carefully because I think the committee has been really good about trying to develop ideas, and I've seen ties go to the board numerous times, which I think was beneficial for staff to get a clear direction. And I've also seen situations where the handwriting's on the wall and the discussion's been had and we move on. And that's generally been left up to the committee members to kind of work that out. Whichever way, I think Director Cawley is asking that the board, you know, that the board have the opportunity to consider the question. If we put this on calendar, I guess it would go in January. So the new board would essentially be presented with this analysis and any supplement that we can answer on some of the questions, like the legal question. Alternatively, we could try to develop some of those answers and bring it to the new, whatever the newly constituted finance committee is that starts up next year. It may end up being very much portions of the same committee. I think, RJ, you can dial in if you really want to listen to from the East Coast time zone anytime, you know, just to listen. You can now comment as a resident, I guess, too. I guess I'd throw those as sort of three possible ideas. One is, pause it here. The other is take it forward to the board. Or the third is do a little bit of tidying up and bring it back to the new committee and see if there's a different outcome at that point. I will say the most efficient thing from a staff standpoint would be either the first or the second option, because most of the clarifications are fairly minor, I think.
So. Right. I don't know who the new blood will be on the finance committee, if there is any new, but I like the option of bringing it back in January to finance to get a second opinion and potentially moving it to the board, or if it's stalemated here, then it doesn't go anywhere. I did see Dr. Armitage's hand up out of the peripheral vision, so I'm not ignoring you.
Thanks. And thanks for dragging me in. Appreciate that.
Okay. I just want to follow up on...
A comes before B, so... Okay.
Just to follow up on something that Director Cawley had mentioned, I, you know, you use the word subsidy, and what comes to mind is I don't know that that's an accurate term to use, because I see it as a cost of doing business, right? I feel like each method of payment that we have has a cost of doing business attached to it. And it seems to me that, you know, you're looking specifically at credit card payments, and you explain that perhaps it's because people who have specific credit cards and they have, you know, 1-2% cash back can then maybe afford that. It won't be such a financial hit on them. So I don't know. It bothers me just to use the term subsidy because I don't see it as that way. It's a cost of doing business in my mind.
Right. And so, Dr. Brunson,
yeah,
we're not going to continue to debate this, just so you know.
So. Okay. No. So, well, why not? A, but B,
because I'm retiring.
We're going to make you serve it all out forever. My comment was very similar to Director Armitage, and I wanted to ask, is it really just the Pay Near Me and the credit cards that have fees, or are there fees that we accrue by other payment methods?
Every payment method has a cost.
Okay, so but we are
between a cost and the fee. What we're talking about is the fee above and beyond processing.
So that's, I guess that's the question. How much more are we actually paying for credit cards to be an option versus other methods? And I really don't think, again, that it's fair to call it a subsidy when everybody is getting subsidized in the method that they are using. Also, I'll bring it back to the fact that it comes from a very specific point of view of saying that credit card users are doing it for the points or doing it for the cash back. And I understand that that's your life experience and the people that you know, but that's not the reality. So really what you're saying is my point of view is the only point of view that is valid. And we are going to be and everybody else's, you know, all these other scenarios are not important enough. And so we're going to be punishing everybody because I'm viewing it as a subsidy instead of viewing it as Director Armitage says, cost of doing business.
So I'm going to jump in here because it is inappropriate for any director to simply restate what I have said and by misstating what I have said, because any director on this board should always tread very carefully when they are trying to restate an opinion that another director has said. Okay. And so I did not say hardly anything of what you said that I did. Okay. Now, I have said, to be clear, that there are people like me who are motivated by a 2% back. I also acknowledge the fact that you are correct that there are people that pay because they need the float. It doesn't matter to me what their motivation is. What matters to me is that the 70% who do not pay by credit card are paying for those relatively large processing fees. Okay. And all of our ratepayers would benefit if we had the $300,000 a year or thereabouts that we are now paying in those fees. So I would ask you to please refrain from saying I said something which I did not say. And the best way to do that is to not try to accuse somebody else of saying something. I'll speak for myself and you don't need to repeat what I say. Does that make sense?
Okay. I apologize that you felt that I was attacking you or misrepresenting what you is that totally fine. So not restating with what you said, everybody is getting subsidies. Everybody here is paying for some, we are paying for some, for a payment that is happening. And I think that there are enough reasons that were raised here between security, anxiety, needing to be able to float it because you can't balance it all out, to not penalize those people. And again, too, the fact that it makes it easier to get our money is worth something as well.
So it's interesting how such a slightly easy presentation turns into a large conversation, dwelling everything from do the people that use the cards, pay the money and reduce costs for the other people, versus whether everybody's subsidized. So I think you now have your direction. Communicate to come back in January to your finance committee with a little bit more, whether it's Director Colley that talks to you or whoever the new chair is that talks to you and gives you a little bit more direction there. And then from there, at the recommendation of finance, it can then go to the board or it can stay as is.
Okay. I have a couple directions, but I think I'm still missing one. So discussing with legal to making sure that we can charge just one group of customers using one payment method. And then also, if we have time to have get the option of PayPal and Venmo and bringing that in and seeing what that cost is. We also need to look at the billing system and making sure what it would take to add on that fee for the credit card and whatever portals that we use to add that function. Also making sure in the accounting system too that that is set up, because we have a interface between the billing system and the accounting system. And then also the messaging, especially to those auto pay customers that typically don't look at a bill, that I'm assuming they would probably have to accept that they would be paying a fee each time. I don't know, there's thousands of those. So I would think whenever it happens, it would be probably maybe a few months down the road to make sure we can get a couple, two or three billing cycles with messaging for the auto pay customers. But the last thing I think I'm missing is to bring back in any kind of recommendation is what percentage or dollar per transaction do we want to analyze, so we can put that in our financial recommendations. Is there a consensus?
You know, Rochelle, maybe I'll try it, unless you
direct your preference. Yeah, what my preference it was is just you tell the credit card processing folks that we don't pay the fee. The customer pays the fee. It's a binary choice, as it was presented to us in 2019, that we had a choice. Either we absorb it or the customer absorbs it. So
I don't,
so that'd be my choice.
I don't think it can work in that function.
No.
Because a credit card company doesn't charge it. We collect it to reimburse ourselves. So if we got one credit card company, Visa's charging 1.9 and American Express is charging 3.5 because of the time frame of collection, you know, we're going to charge based on either a flat rate that you're going to analyze and come back with a recommendation that the average may be 2.25, and everybody's going to pay that on whatever their bill is, whatever their charge is. But that's how I see the answer to Ed's question. So if that's cleared up, then fine. If you need to have Mr. Stone make his two cents worth, we'll be glad to listen to him.
I think that's about where I was going to go. I think it's really more of a determining what's a reasonable average cost to recover the credit card transaction costs. Okay. I know when I've paid things through a portal where they do recover that, they don't say, tell me which credit card you have and right. We'll tell you what it's going to cost. It's
like charge.
They make some business decisions. Right. Some of them go all the way to 3%. I think we would, because we're a public agency, we'd set a fee that we could reasonably justify based on the average cost of those transactions, and which makes it not a rate also. It's just recovering a cost of that function.
So nice presentation. Don't let it happen again.
So, wanted your last meeting to go on as long as possible.
So if I could ask then, if we're going to bring this back in January, which is fine, that I get some clarification on that, if the option exists to simply tell the processor that's processing all these things that just, you know, we want, if their bill is $39.26, we want $39.26, whatever you charge. That's your business model and your decision. That's the way it was presented in 2019, I believe. If that option does not exist, it does complicate the question, obviously, quite a bit. But again, if that option still exists, I would like to know about it. If it no longer exists for some reason, I would be surprised, but I would want to know that as well.
Okay, the question's clarified. I appreciate that.
Thanks. Okay. All right, so thank you very much. It was a good presentation, healthy debate. Yeah. And it just shows the diversity of opinions of board members. you know, looking at the agency's, you know, finances versus looking at the rate, you know, the rate holder finances, and, you know, how to come up with a reasonable solution for both. So I look forward to this coming back in January, and we'll move on to item six.
Can I make one final comment? It's not really related directly. Well, no. I this is a comment on a little bit of process and about staff. I want to thank staff for presenting information in a way that is not advocacy for a position and leaving the policy discussion entirely on this side of the dais. And so I very much appreciate that is the approach that was taken. And I thank you for making sure that happens. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, so item six, committee planning calendar.
There is a lot happening in January.
No more than tonight.
So we are bringing back the presentation on our scenario options for our potential financings and rates. Based on that conversation, we are also prepared to have a reimbursement resolution if the committee does decide to recommend a bond for this first phase before hopefully we receive WIFIA financing. We will also be bringing a resolution to amend the HRA contract that we have with IGO to add those retiree option that the board approved last month. And then bringing back the presentations on the ratepayer assistance program, just to kind of get us back to where we were and then get direction on where we should be moving forward. And that's January is big. And then February, we have a couple presentations. We have an update with IT and our fleet and warehousing department. And we're also looking at our starting our fiscal year. We'll have our budget review and look at our calendar for our next budget cycle. We will also be looking at our Valencia retail capacity fee draft study in February. And also looking to bring back the debt management policy after we've had our discussions on bond and rates, and we'll bring back our debt management policy to finally refine that and get that revision approved. And that's pretty much what I have on the calendar, unless you guys have any comments on that.
Any public comment?
No public comment at this time.
Anything else from directors on the calendar? Okay. Future agenda items? Seeing none, move into item 8, general report on finance administration activities.
I don't think I have anything new to add. Everything seems to be on the calendar. I will come back with next month, and we'll just have a general discussion on where we are with our accounts receivable, just as an update.
No public comment.
No public comment at this time.
All right, so we're at adjournment. You're not public.
I just want to say, since this is Chair Kelly's last meeting as chair of this committee, just want to say thank you. In the couple of years that I have been on the board, I've appreciated your thoughtful, your calm, and fair style of leadership. And I have enjoyed learning from you, and I have loved laughing from your humor that you have shared with us. So this is a pretty fun committee to be on, because I think you keep it light when you can and bring some humor into it. So thank you. So I will miss you chairing this committee, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Now adjournment. Thank you.
Thank you.